Insurance isn't one size fits all, and shopping for it shouldn't feel like squeezing into something that just doesn't fit. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they show you options that fit your budget. Enough hunting for discounts, trying to calculate rates, and tinkering with coverages. Maybe you're picking out your very first policy, or maybe you're just looking for something that works better for you and your family. Either way, they make it simple to see your options. No guesswork, no surprises. Ready to see how easy and fun shopping for car insurance can be? Visit Progressive.com and give the Name Your Price tool a try. Take the stress out of shopping and find coverage that fits your life on your terms. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Cops are calling it a disturbing house of horrors while searching this sprawling property. They say they found shocking videotapes.
Was this dilapidated property a torture chamber and slaughterhouse?
One day the phone calls just stopped and we knew it was something deeper.
Hey, true crime besties. Welcome back to an all new episode of Serialistly.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly with me, your host, Annie Elise. Happy Monday. I feel like back-to-back now, two Mondays in a row, I am probably ruining your day, if not your week, especially given today's case and everything that we're going to be discussing. Because, first of all, let me start by saying this. I have seen your DMs for the last couple of weeks asking me not only to cover this, but also, like, Annie, can you make sense of this? What the hell is going on? Is this the world's biggest serial killer that has finally been caught? What's really going on inside this house? Is this like an actual real life version of Silence of the Lambs? And the reason it's taken me so long to do the deep dive into this case, even though we've discussed it a little bit on Headline Highlights, is because I knew I needed to do the deep dive. Like, go back through and look up everything I could possibly find and figure out just how layered this is and how deep this case goes, which I gotta tell you, for my own mental health, I kind of wish I didn't do that because it is so foul, so disgusting, and just, I don't even know the word, like diabolical, yes, but like just unbelievable. So like I said, I know that oftentimes I ruin your day with a lot of these episodes. This one, it's probably going to ruin your week because it is especially grotesque. Now, before we get into it, if you are a newer listener, let me give you the breakdown of everything that we do over here on Serialistly together. As I said, my name is Annie Elise, and I deliver these true crime cases for you every Monday in a deep dive way where I'm going down the rabbit hole so that you don't have to, going through social media posts, old archival, newspaper clippings, anything I can find on Reddit, on news reports, interviews, FOIAs, police interviews, whatever I can get my hands on so that I can deliver a case to you and do it justice, but also in more of a conversational way so that it doesn't feel so clinical or sterile and just feels like we're talking as friends. So today I've got all my notes with me. We are going to be going through this together. But like I said, I wanted to give you a little bit of a heads up because it certainly is not an easy one to discuss, not that any of them are, but this one you're probably going to want to, you know, have a barf bag handy nearby. So with that, today we are diving in to the Philadelphia Horsch House of Horrors. Say that five times fast, right? Now, if you haven't heard about this case yet, you probably will soon. I'm sure you also have seen it somewhere on your social media feed. But right now, investigators are looking into what could possibly be one of the biggest serial killer cases in the last 50 years. It is massive, and it's unfolding right now in Philadelphia, more specifically in the Olney neighborhood. Now, the investigation actually began around 6 a.m. on June 19th, 2026. This is when a U.S. park ranger stopped a suspicious vehicle. Now, at first, they thought it was going to be, okay, maybe a little suspicious, but an otherwise routine stop. They certainly did not expect that it was going to be anything like what they have uncovered. But what the investigators found inside the vehicle, it would eventually lead them to a very disturbing trail of evidence that was connected to at least 4 different missing women. Now, normally, I would walk you through this case from the very beginning. However, because we're already now about, 2 months behind, I want to speed things up a little bit, and I'm going to use the police department's updated timeline. That way, it'll catch you up to speed with everything that they've been looking into, and you can hear directly from their mouths what they are looking at and what they've uncovered. But then what I want to do is I want to break down what has happened ever since that announcement and how I've been kind of, you know, in the back room doing my own little investigation, connecting all the dots. Picture like a big board with the yarn going from photo to photo and notepad to notepad and post-its all over. Literally, that is what I have been doing. But first, before we get into all of that, let's start with the police timeline. Take a listen.
I'm going to start out with a short recap of the investigation. And it kind of started on June 19th, 8 a.m., at 6th and Market Streets. United States Park police officer conducted a car stop pedestrian investigation at that location. The vehicle was a BMW. In the vehicle were two passengers, a passenger and a driver. The driver was a Eugene Horsch. He's a 44-year-old male from 417 Chew Avenue. The passenger is a white female, provided fake ID in the name of Blair Tunzelli. During the course of this investigation, the street investigation, 2 illegal handguns were recovered from that vehicle, around $8,000 of illegal drugs, which were crack cocaine, heroin, and marijuana, and a DEA badge for credentials. Eugene Horsch's picture was on that ID. During the debriefing process, the name Blair Tunzelli came up again, and we learned through that debriefing process that we may never see her again. Later on that day, and this is Friday into Saturday, the 19th and the 20th, the DEA and officers from the Philadelphia Police Department assigned to the federal task force served a search warrant at 417 Chew Avenue. Recovered another illegal gun, gun parts, a marijuana grow operation with a street value of over $280,000. Another badge, this time it was an FBI badge with credentials, again, with Eugene Horsch's picture on it. Also in the house were 5 urns containing what we believe is the cremated remains. The DEA contacted Tom Walsh. He's the lieutenant in homicide. Homicide opens an investigation on 417 Chew Avenue and the disappearance of Blair Tunzelli. Over the next several days, the homicide unit and special victims, and this is part of the long-term missing person group, conducted several interviews, followed up on the IDs found in 417 Chew Street, and re-interview the friends of Blair Tunzelli. On Friday, June 25th, another search warrant was served at 417 Chew Avenue. At this time, it was led by the homicide unit, crime scene, ATF, and our bomb disposal unit. Found at this time during this search warrant what appeared to be some type of lab or home lab in the basement, various containers containing an unknown oily substance, and over 50 pieces of electronic devices. And this is hard drives, computers, thumb drives, things of that nature. Mike Garvey, who is the director of forensic science, led the investigation during the processing of the crime scene, and he determined the magnitude of the collection process that we have to go through our crime scene unit and the unknown chemicals, we would need assistance. Sunday, June 27th, a call was made through the commissioner to the FBI, and we got the assistance of the FBI evidence recovery team. They came up from Quantico, Virginia, to assist in processing this scene. We processed that home lab and the components, the containers of that unknown substance, and all that digital evidence. Tuesday, June 29th, Deputy Commissioner Venori, head of investigations, put together an investigative team to investigate what's going on in 417 Chew Avenue. That's included homicide, our special victims long-term missing persons group, our Delaware Valley Intelligence Center, representatives from the district attorney's office, and our partners in the FBI and other law enforcement partners. These are some of the investigative findings. We have served over 95 search warrants to date on the house and its contents. The FBI has been a tremendous asset in this investigation and helped us with collecting the evidence and processing the evidence. July 9th, FBI certified K-9 team from the Jersey State Police searched the house and the premises around the house. July 22nd, I know many of you were out there at the location of 417 Chew Avenue. That's when we served the search warrant again on that property to remove the sewer line, the lateral, and the trap. And we wanted to examine the contents in that sewer line. July 27th, the 20 plus containers with the unknown substance was delivered to a special lab in Chicago for testing and analysis. The beginning of August, the digital evidence that we served search warrants on started coming in. We utilized the RCFL, and that's the Regional Computer Forensic Lab. The amount of information and digital evidence that we got was astonishing. The investigators in that investigative group, we have to look over 600,000 images, 70,000 videos, and over 10,000 pages of writings, manuscripts, and drawings. We have to review and organize those. Why do I say this? This investigation will take time. There's a lot of evidence to go through. While searching the first hard drive, homicide detectives found the images and video of what appeared to be two deceased females. Those females have been identified. We know who they are. This is new territory for the homicide unit in Philadelphia. Usually when we have a homicide investigation, we have a body, we have body parts. This time we do not. This has turned into a death investigation. Again, will be protracted. This is taking all the energy of some really, really senior detectives in homicide to solve exactly what's going on here.
Now, that is obviously a lot of very creepy, very disturbing information to unpack, right? A lot of dark information. So according to the police, at this time, they've only been able to review 5 to 7% of the digital evidence. That's it. 5 to 7%. So in reality, this could take the police weeks, months, even years to really uncover what has been going on and truly investigate this case. But if you're like me, you have a lot of questions that need answers now. And that is where I have been hard at work for all of you. So, and you may have noticed, I've been a little quiet on social media lately, and it's because I have been diving into the darkest corners of this case, using old webpage archives, going into historical records, trying to piece it all together with old newspaper clippings, anything really that I could just get my hands on to try to make sense of what's going on here. So let's not waste any time, and I want to start with a recap of what evidence has been recovered since those 95 search warrants. 95, okay? So during the initial traffic stop, the investigators identified the driver of the BMW as 44-year-old Eugene Horsch. And guys, I want you to stay with me because later in this episode, I am going to give you his entire background story. So during this stop, they found two illegal handguns that had tampered serial numbers, $8,000 worth of illegal drugs, drugs like crack cocaine, heroin, marijuana, a DEA badge and ID, which, you know, the DEA, like Drug Enforcement Task Force, right? So a DEA badge and ID that had Eugene's photo on it, a switchblade, collapsible baton, cattle prod, and many other various suspicious items. Now, as for the woman who was traveling with Eugene, she was found carrying identification that had the name Blair Tonzelli, yet her photo was on it. Now, she reportedly told the police that Eugene had created this fake ID for her, which We now know that she was actually a missing person. So that prompted the investigators to revisit Blair's 2023 missing person case, where they had found a friend's statement that she was last seen at an address of 417 West Chew Avenue. And sure enough, that is what prompted the police to go and search Eugene's home. Now, during the first search, which also was that same day, they discovered the following items inside the home: large quantities of chemicals, 20 containers of unidentified chemical substances, which have now been sent to a Chicago lab for forensic processing, a basement resembling a chemical laboratory, even more additional firearms, a marijuana/drug-related operation worth about $250,000, approximately 120 pieces of ballistic evidence, a 55-gallon drum with pipes and hoses that were connected to water lines, all leading toward this underground area, more hidden compartments, multiple cameras and security features, fake IDs, fake documents, another fake government badge. This time it was an FBI badge and it had Eugene's name. They found Blair's bank and debit card. They found 5 urns of cremated remains and more than 10,000 pages, okay? 10,000 pages of written materials and drawings, including an unsigned handwritten note that mentioned zip ties, Ted Bundy, killing and harming people, a drum, and ways to dispose of trash. They also found, I think, the mother load, 50 electronic devices, including multiple hard drives, computers, USB flash drives, cameras, and phones. Which, remember, they have only gone through 5-7% of the electronic evidence that they have. They found over 50 devices, and I wish I had a device right here to show you for all my video viewers. I record into a 2 terabyte hard drive, but it's this big. It's the size of like a cigarette pack, okay? Not even as thick as that, way thinner, but the like shape of it is like a cigarette pack. So if they found over 50 devices, and terabytes are, that holds an incredibly high amount of data, they could have so much that they need to sort through over the years. It could take a long time. Now, when I first heard about everything that they found, the drums, the hidden compartments, the camera and security footage, all the, you know, drug operation worth $250,000, in my mind, what immediately came to mind was Breaking Bad. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that show. I've rewatched it probably like 3 or 4 times. It's the best. But they have underneath the laundromat this whole drug operation with big drums, you know, water lines, pipes. And obviously, I don't think this was as intricate as that or as professional as that, but it definitely made me think of that. Because it also, I want to just read this again. Large quantities of chemicals, 20 containers of unidentified chemical substances that had to be sent off to the lab for testing. So certainly, I mean, something nefarious going on, right? Whether you are using those chemicals in this drug operation or using these chemicals to dispose of things, evidence, people, remains, I don't know, but maybe something acidic is in there. The fact that he had 5 urns, that doesn't feel great. The fact that he had 2 fake badges, one for DEA, one for FBI, that looks a little bit concerning as well, right? And then, of course, the 10,000 pages of handwritten materials and notes about Bundy, zip ties, cleaning up, killing people. That kind of feels like it was ripped out of Rex Huerman, the Long Island serial killer's playbook. Because as we know, he kept a diary of sorts where it was his playbook of his sick fetishes and his preparation documents and what he wanted to do to these women. It just is so disturbing on like a whole different level. Now, keep in mind too, okay, this was only day one of the investigation. Can you imagine being one of those officers walking into this house thinking, okay, we might find a little bit of evidence, and then finding the mother load like that? That would be insane. And to be like, holy shit, guys, we're only on day one. Like, what else are we going to find in all of this? If you're anything like me, There is nothing worse than waking up in the middle of the night because you're like sweating and hot and uncomfortable and just feeling like gross and disgusting. And let me just tell you this. When two people share a bed, somehow I feel like one person is always freezing cold while the other one is overheating. And I am the one who is overheating. But that's why I love the idea behind Orion Sleep. Because Orion is a smart sleep system that fits right over the mattress that you already have. And it lets each side of the bed have its own personalized temperature. So you can set your side anywhere from 50 to 115 degrees. And while you sleep, Orion senses how your body responds and then uses that data to improve your sleep over time. And because temperature can impact things like deep sleep, REM sleep, overnight wake-ups, I'm really curious to see what my own sleep data would look like once I start using it, because you best believe I already have mine on the way and I'm going to start ordering this because I'm so sick of Jeremiah stacking all the covers, doing that, and like being so hot throughout the night. Like I need ice cubes in my bed, okay? Plus, Orion comes with free shipping, a 30-day free trial with a full refund, and a 2-year warranty. And right now, Orion is offering our listeners 15% off at oriansleep.com/AE. That's oriansleep.com/AE for 15% off. Get better sleep backed by your own data at oriansleep.com/AE. Insurance isn't one size fits all, and shopping for it shouldn't feel like squeezing into something that just doesn't fit. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they show you options that fit your budget. Enough hunting for discounts, trying to calculate rates, and tinkering with coverages. Maybe you're picking out your very first policy, or maybe you're just looking for something that works better for you and your family. Either way, they make it simple to see your options. No guesswork, no surprises. Ready to see how easy and fun shopping for car insurance can be? Visit Progressive.com and give the Name Your Price tool a try. Take the stress out of shopping and find coverage that fits your life on your terms. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
So the Philadelphia police then bring in their homicide team, since they are the most qualified unit to collect all of that evidence. And the department also notified the ATF for the illegal firearms, the DEA for the fake credentials and the drug operation, and the FBI for the fake FBI credentials, and also so that they could help assist with the investigation and with Eugene's arrest. So by early July, an entire task force had been created to tackle this house of horrors, including Philadelphia's PD Bureaus of Detectives, Specialized Homicide and Special Victims Long-Term Missing Persons Units, the Delaware Valley Intelligence Center, the District Attorney, and medical examiner's offices, multiple state and federal law enforcement agencies, and also agents from the FBI headquarters in Quantico, Virginia. So the fact that they enlisted the help of all of these different agencies, I think that that really just goes to show how insane this truly is. So with the task force now being established and the FBI taking the lead, Eugene was federally indicted and he was charged with being a felon who was in possession of firearms and also possession of fraudulent federal identification documents. So throughout the month of July, the task force continued searching the property and they were really focusing on some particular areas of interest. starting with that 55-gallon drum, which that led the police to physically excavate different parts of the property. They knew that they needed to examine the underground piping and that they needed to use cameras to look beneath the building. Because think about it, if there are all of these chemicals and this huge 55-gallon drum and pipes that were attached to these chemicals going leading underground, they need to get to the bottom of it. Quite literally, right? No pun intended. So they did have to excavate, dig deep, see where these lines and pipes were going to, what was really connected underneath the ground level, and what were they trying to operate, and what kind of system was really in place here. And I also just want to mention this. Chemicals aside, anytime I hear that somebody personally has one or multiple large drums inside their basement, it immediately takes me to Drew Peterson, not to be confused with Scott Peterson. But if you remember, Drew Peterson allegedly put his wife, Stacy, inside a drum and disposed of her remains, and she has never been found to this day. And I think it's because people can either dump the drum inside a body of water and it will sink, and they cement it, and they encase the whole thing with cement and make it incredibly heavy, or you have something acidic and certain chemicals that basically disintegrate remains and body parts inside that drum to where then it becomes nothing but liquid or gas, and then you get rid of the bones and all of that. So I don't know. Maybe it's because I live in California and I've never needed a drum like that. But anytime I hear about a case involving a drum, my mind immediately is like, oh, clocking that. Something weird is going on. Why does this person have a drum and chemicals? Like, something does not smell right here. So they also, in their investigation, took blood samples. And investigators had initially believed that they discovered a significant amount of blood-like material inside the property. However, forensic testing later determined that the substance was not blood. They also took DNA samples. However, so far they've said that the DNA testing did not match Blair on any of the items examined. But let's talk about that handwritten letter that I mentioned earlier, right? The one that had a lot of unhinged things written down on it and things about Ted Bundy, harming people, disposal methods, things like that. Well, investigators found that letter disturbing enough that they included it in the probable cause affidavit. But remember, this letter was unsigned. So that is where this case takes another insane turn. Because at first you would think, oh, okay, it must have belonged to Eugene. It was Eugene's house. He's the one who was arrested. It's all of his weird ass shit that they're discovering. However, this letter is unsigned. And here's where it gets interesting. During Eugene's bond hearing, his attorney suggested that this letter could have been written by his father, writer and filmmaker Raymond Horsch, and that not only could he have been the one who authored it, but that it may have simply been some sort of fictional or creative writing, not necessarily a how-to or a plan or a recollection of events like Rex Huerman. Now, really quickly before we continue, I do want to pause for a second and I want to recap a few things because this case, it has a lot of moving parts, okay? And it's also about to take another crazy ass turn. And I really want to give you the most accurate timeline of events that I can, yet without causing confusion. So by the end of July, now a whole month and a half into this entire ordeal, the investigators did have a ton of evidence. But still, they had not recovered any human remains, not aside from those five urns that they had found inside the basement. They also recovered no blood or DNA samples coming back as a match for Blair. They had no information on her whereabouts. And although it looked very compelling and very sinister, they still didn't have a lot of concrete answers. But what they did have was new information regarding who may have written that disturbing letter. So naturally, the next person that the investigators wanted to speak with and wanted to question was going to be Eugene's father, Raymond. But the problem was, Raymond died a year earlier in May of 2025. So instead, they did the next best thing. They knew they needed to dig into Raymond's background. If they weren't there to speak with him physically, they needed to dig into his history a little bit more and see what he was all about, see if there was anything weird in his past or on his record. And one thing that I do want to say about Raymond is that he wasn't just any old writer or filmmaker. He also was an erotic photographer. And even more than just the still photos, he got into filmmaking. He not only directed, but also starred in his own pornographic films. And these weren't just your run-of-the-mill secretary films and, you know, porn movies where it's like, oh, it's the neighbor and they're bringing me over a casserole and now we're going to start like boning on the sofa. No, these were films where he was spending decades documenting women in sadomasochistic settings, which if you're not familiar with that term, it basically means that these films were documenting and illustrating some very disturbing and violent acts. Sadist type acts where people get off on not only inflicting pain, but also receiving pain. Think BDSM, but even a step further than that, which that's really disturbing too when you hear that some of the things that were found in Eugene's car were like a cattle prod and things like that, because sometimes, not always, but sometimes some of those tools are used in situations like that. And you can look that up at your own discretion. I'm not going to go into a ton of details, but I would imagine if you're a true crime follower or listener, you probably have heard the term sadist before, masochist, sadomasochistic. I mean, it's just very disturbing. But even more than that, Raymond had an extensive criminal history as well. And when investigators started digging through his past, they uncovered another missing person case that was connected to that same home. And sure enough, that missing person was a lot closer to home too, because it was his ex-wife, Amy McHale. She disappeared back in 2016 and still to this day has never been found. So at this point, investigators now had two missing women who were connected to this particular house. But that would change yet again when the electronic evidence came back in early August of 2026, giving the investigators a major break in this case. Because get this, as I explained how so much data can be stored on such an like a small electronic device, investigators reportedly recovered over 600,000 images, and they also recovered more than 70,000 videos. And that digital evidence allegedly appeared to show two different missing women, both alive and then later deceased. The women were identified as Maribel Freshes, who has been missing since 2018, and Gabrielle Armando, missing since 2012. Authorities notified both families. However, neither woman's remains have been recovered. Now, as a result, police are treating the case as a death investigation, but they expect the cases to be upgraded to a homicide as they continue the investigation. So that means that with these two missing women, additional missing women, that brings the total to four confirmed missing women who are connected to that house. You have Blair Tonzelli, which is the key to this entire investigation. Blair was last seen in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in August of 2022. She was supposed to meet up with friends one afternoon, but never showed up, and she has never been heard from again. She often frequented the neighborhood of Kensington. She struggled with opioid addiction, and she had been arrested for drug and solicitation charges. But get this, at the time of her disappearance, she was associated with a man named Raymond, who lived in the neighborhood of Olney and who sold marijuana. So she would drop out of sight, go see him, then she would return home eventually. But after her trip to see, quote, Raymond in August of 2022, she never returned home. The tough thing was Blair was pretty much estranged from her family. So her friends ended up reporting her missing in February of 2023. This was after months had passed without any contact. The second missing person is Maribel Freshes. She was the one who was found on the hard drive. Maribel was last seen at her boyfriend's home in the Kensington area of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and this was sometime in June or July of 2018. Now, she has never been heard from again, and investigators believe that she may have been murdered. Next, we have Amy McHale, who, remember, was Raymond's ex-wife. So on June 13th, 2016, 44-year-old Amy was last seen at Raymond's home. The two had previously been married, but they remained close, and Amy would also periodically return to the home. So Amy left her daughter a voicemail saying that she was safe and she was at Raymond's house. But that was the last communication that her family ever received from her, and she never came back home. Raymond reportedly told the police that Amy had been drinking, that he went to bed, and that by the time he woke up, she was gone. Yet her mother and daughter spent years searching for her. But Amy remained a missing person. No body was ever recovered, and Raymond was never publicly charged with a homicide that was connected to her disappearance. But it does feel a little bit fishy, right? We say, where there's smoke, there's fire. You have four missing women connected to this house, one of whom is your ex-wife, who she said that she was at your house in a message to her daughter and then was never seen or heard from again. Now, for the fourth missing woman, that is Gabrielle Armando. She also was found on the hard drive like Maribel. Gabrielle went missing in 2012. Her mother later said on social media that she had tried everything to help her daughter before her disappearance, but now she believes that Gabrielle was murdered. So again, this does not look great. And with that, I really want to get into the two men who are at the center of all of this, because I genuinely cannot wrap my head around how much information I was able to pull from the internet archives, let alone how I managed to piece together this entire timeline. It is unbelievable. However, the deeper that I went, the more I started noticing some really unsettling parallels to the movie Silence of the Lambs. And I want to be clear, this is my interpretation. I've seen a couple people talk about it on socials, but it's my interpretation based on my research and what I have found. It is not a claim and it's not proof of what was actually happening behind closed doors. Because when you look at the facts and you look at Eugene and Raymond's relationship, it raises a very uncomfortable question. Was this just a father and son relationship? Or was there something much darker and much more complicated going on between the two of them? The dynamic between them honestly started reminding me of the relationship between Hannibal Lecter and Buffalo Bill. And if you haven't seen that movie, it's iconic. You should totally watch it. But what you need to know about both of those characters is that they were very different people who, yet their disturbing interests and actions became intertwined. So now that I've laid that out there, I want you to consider this your official warning, because we're about to get into some really dark parts of the family history. And once we start pulling apart Raymond and Eugene's past, there is no going back. So grab your emotional support water bottle, do whatever you need to do. Shit's about to get deep right now. Let's start with this family history, okay? Raymond Horsch, better known by his alias name, R.C. Horsch, was born in 1943 and he was raised in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He married his 19-year-old high school sweetheart in 1964, and together they moved to Philadelphia. There, Raymond worked in commercial film and photography while his wife taught school. He later joined the National Guard, but he left so that he could avoid active duty in Vietnam. And instead, he moved to New York City, where there he pursued film and his own very highly sexualized photography. His high school sweetheart, who was also his first wife, ended up leaving him in 1970 after finding a woman's nightgown on their bed. She later described Raymond as an emotionally abusive philanderer, saying he also had an enormous ego, saying, quote, "Raymond really thought he was smarter than anybody, and he thought that he could get away with anything." So his wife leaves him, probably for cheating, more than likely, and this is already when he's focusing on this adult industry career. And in the early 1970s, he worked on a lot of various porn productions before then befriending Philly's mob associate, Salvatore Sam the Barber LaRusciu. Now, Sam the Barber is actually the one who helped him produce his very own low-budget erotic film in 1973. And that's not all he was doing. He was also running his own underground counterfeiting operation where he would have counterfeit dollar bills, $10 bills. So ultimately, though, the filmmaking career was cut short because in 1974, the Secret Service busted that counterfeiting operation and they seized more than $1 million in fake $10 bills. Then, after his release, Raymond was arrested once again in 1977 for operating a meth lab in Philadelphia. Which that's really interesting, because think about the lab or makeshift lab that looked to have been built in the basement in the house that the investigators recently went to. It seems like this was possibly something that started decades ago and either continued within the family or maybe even was passed down in the family. So facing more prison time, he ended up skipping bail and he fled to the West Coast with his longtime girlfriend, Anna. He then stole the identity of Dr. Stanley Eugene Stokorsky, a real-life California chemist with a Stanford doctorate. Which I know identity theft is running rampant, but like, this is wild, right? The fact that he is just assuming another person's identity. In 1980, Raymond ended up marrying Anna in Nevada, and he used this California chemist's alias. And then the couple fled to New Zealand so that they could evade federal investigators. And again, I just want to keep doing this kind of callback to what was found in the car. We know with his son Eugene, they found the DEA badge, the FBI badge that had Eugene's credentials on him, and found just these different fake identifications. So again, is it something that was learned by his dad and a trade that was passed down to him? Did he idolize his dad? And it was just like, oh, my dad got away with it, I can get away with it too. But you start to see a pattern here. And that's not even the only pattern we see, because get this, Raymond ended up using his drug manufacturing experience and his faked credentials to land himself a real job as a chemist with an alternative fuels company. And there he launched a facility where he converted whey into ethanol. So now you have this pattern and this history of fake credentials, chemicals, labs, thinking you're a chemist. It's pretty unsettling. In 1981, Anna ended up giving birth to the couple's only son, none other than Eugene. After Eugene was born, Raymond continued traveling between the US and New Zealand, but he always would use different aliases. Then, in 1984, so just a couple of years later, Raymond was caught entering New Zealand with 5 fake passports. But that didn't stop him. He allegedly stole another passport and then fled back to the US, leaving Anna and Eugene behind. The FBI, though, eventually arrested him in Orlando and then extradited him back to Philadelphia in 1985. So it's like you have this Breaking Bad meets Catch Me If You Can, if you know that movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, this weird ass situation going on. And I understand that maybe police departments didn't have as many resources back then, but how he got away with this and was playing this game of catch and release with them is beyond me. So once he was extradited back to Philadelphia in 1985, a court-ordered psychologist described Raymond as having an IQ of 140, but said he had deep-rooted emotional problems. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison, and later he even said, "I loved being a fugitive." After his release, Raymond moved his family to Northeast Philadelphia, and then he began working as an IT director. His wife, Anna, ended up dying in 1989 at age 39 from an accidental drug overdose, all while 7-year-old Eugene was inside the room. Which, that is just devastating. I mean, dying at such a young age, 39, your 7-year-old son in the room witnessing this, which 7-year-olds have great memory. That's some sort of trauma that is going to stick with him. You would hope that with something happening so awful and heartbreaking and devastating, that Raymond would want to be there for his son, that he would be heartbroken and want to make sure that his son was okay, maybe put him into counseling, therapy, whatever he needed to do. But instead, after Anna's death, Raymond said that he was angry at Anna. More specifically, angry that she, quote, bailed out and left me with a kid to raise. I've been learning a lot more about the importance of dental health lately, especially because so many of the things that we have every day, like coffee, tea, acidic foods, Diet Coke, personal attack on me, they can really take a toll on your teeth over time. So I've been trying Lorene, which is a better-for-you chewing gum that actually supports your enamel while you chew. Now get this, they use the same mineral that your enamel is actually made of so that it strengthens your enamel and repairs damage. Lorene sent me their gum. I tried it. I'm a huge fan. It tastes really good. My mouth feels fresh, and it's such an easy thing to just throw in my handbag and chew throughout the day. They also have tons of flavors. They have mint, cinnamon, bubblegum, berry, plus a fluoride-free toothpaste. And right now, Lorene is offering our listeners up to 50% off at buylorene.com/AE. That's buylorene, LARINE.com/AE for up to 50% off. Insurance isn't one size fits all, and shopping for it shouldn't feel like squeezing into something that just doesn't fit. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they show you options that fit your budget. Enough hunting for discounts, trying to calculate rates, and tinkering with coverages. Maybe you're picking out your very first policy, or maybe you're just looking for something that works better for you and your family. Either way, they make it simple to see your options. No guesswork, no surprises. Ready to see how easy and fun shopping for car insurance can be? Visit Progressive.com and give the Name Your Price tool a try. Take the stress out of shopping and find coverage that fits your life on your terms. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try on new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Really just focused on himself. Not his 7-year-old son. And in the years after Anna's death, he ended up opening a barbecue restaurant, pursued his art, and raised Eugene as a single father. Then, in the early 1990s, Raymond placed an ad in the newspaper looking for a housekeeper. Maybe this was to lure someone in, maybe it was to really assist in some of the caretaking, who really knows. But he ended up hiring a teenage girl who was 33 years younger than him and who was struggling with heroin addiction. Just feels like a very creepy, exploitative move. In 1994, he directed and starred in a movie called Lovers, which was a feminist-produced porn film. He also appeared in at least 8 other low-budget adult films. Through all of this, too, he continued photographing sex workers in the Kensington area, often allegedly offering money or drugs for these nude photo shoots. And then he later launched Erato.com, which was a website that featured sexually violent material and various images of women who appeared to be using drugs. So despite calling himself a feminist and bolstering that attitude, Raymond remained unapologetic about exploiting these vulnerable drug-addicted females in his photography and his films. And Erato was basically like the OnlyFans of today, but back then, where it just was all of these compromising and salacious photos of these women. He was trying to make money off of it. It wasn't like a sell per post type of situation because the internet wasn't evolved to that yet, but it was where some of the darkest and grossest material on the internet was published. Now, as for Eugene, Eugene was now in high school, and he was a straight-A student at Central Bucks West. However, classmates said that they had secondhand embarrassment by his father Raymond's career, calling his porn career creepy, and because of that, Raymond was creepy and kind of a monster and just a gross guy all around. So with that, Eugene wasn't exactly Mr. Popularity. He didn't have a ton of friends. However, he wasn't a total loner in all of this. He did have a small group of friends that spent a lot of time in Raymond's backyard trailer. There, they would smoke weed from Raymond's own homegrown operation. They'd listen to Wu-Tang. They'd skateboard and kind of just be, you know, I don't know what the word, like a burnout, basically. And I'm not trying to say that to like shade anybody, but just that was kind of the situation. That's what it was. Old friends of Eugene's said that he did have a pretty complex family dynamic, but that he also shared some of his father Raymond's interests. Interests in chemistry, forgery, evading authorities, and also that he would steal from different stores and use drugs himself sometimes. Then, during his senior year, he ended up losing an older cousin who was very close to him. It was not only a close friend and family member of his, but also a role model. This cousin was only 19 years old and died in a car crash, and this really affected Eugene mentally. So it feels as though Eugene was maybe just struggling to find his place, find a good group of friends. He did have a cousin who was a role model who then tragically died at 19 years old. So then he was struggling mentally. Yet in his high school yearbook, he ended up thanking his dad. Despite their complicated relationship, he thanked him for everything that he had done for him. Now, Eugene apparently never officially graduated from this high school, from Central Bucks West, and a friend also later claimed that he had forged his diploma so that he could attend Drexel University.
Now, why he didn't graduate, I'm not sure, because we know he was a straight A student. So I don't know if after the loss of his cousin, he just spiraled downhill, if maybe he got so embedded in the drug scene or what it was. But for whatever reason, he allegedly forged his diploma so that he could then go to university. However, his academic career ended in 2003 after a drunk driving crash in Northeast Philadelphia after he had ran a red light and T-boned another vehicle. The other driver suffered a catastrophic brain injury and remained in a vegetative state for 16 years. Then he later died. In 2004, Eugene pleaded guilty to DUI and aggravated assault, and he was sentenced to 2 to 4 years in prison. Meanwhile, his father, Raymond, he was continuing to be on the prowl for different women, particularly women who reminded him of his late wife, Anna. He recruited women that he met through friends, prisons, just the general area, and sometimes would offer money or drugs in exchange for appearing in his films. And sure enough, that is when Raymond met Amy McHale. He met her in Kensington while she was struggling with addiction and mental health issues. And after he helped her off the streets, she became very close to him, and they married in September of 2004. That same year, Raymond inherited a home from his deceased aunt. And it was none other than the home that has been at the center of this entire investigation, 413 Chew Avenue. After inheriting this home, he used it as his place of business, as his porn and photography studio. And in 2006, when Eugene was released from prison, he moved into this home himself. Raymond ended up even transferring the property into Eugene's name. Fast forward a couple of more years, and in 2008, Amy and Raymond divorced, yet they still remained friends and pretty close. And the following year, in 2009, police responded to a reported burglary at that home, the same home that he had once shared with Amy. When the authorities arrived, they discovered 455 marijuana plants and 2 shotguns. So federal authorities seized the property, and Raymond later pleaded guilty to 3 felonies and received a 54-month prison sentence. And he wasn't going to let that prison sentence go to waste. No time wasted. Because while incarcerated, Raymond wrote novels about serial killers and sexual deviance. Then, a few years later in 2012, that is when Gabrielle disappeared. Now, it's important to note that at the time that she went missing, Raymond was still in prison. However, Eugene was still living in the Chew Avenue house. And now the timeline is going to start to get a little bit complicated with some back and forth with timelines. So just stick with me as I try to explain it as best as I can. So in 2012, Gabrielle goes missing, but Raymond was still in prison and Eugene was still living at the house, and she was not tied to either one of them. However, a year later, in March of 2013, Eugene, who was now 31 years old, he was arrested during a routine traffic stop. And during this stop, police noticed multiple burn marks on him, also dirt under his fingernails and fresh marijuana plants that were in the vehicle. So that led them to go search the Chew Avenue home, the infamous main property that we've been talking about in this episode. There, police discovered a large-scale marijuana operation with 190 plants and 20 pounds of packaged marijuana. The total value was at around $1.9 million. So Eugene pleaded guilty, and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. However, when the house was searched, the police did not find a female. So I'm unsure if Gabrielle was still alive at that point or not, or what had really happened there. They didn't find anyone, and they hadn't really tied him to anything at that point. There is some fair speculation based on the hidden compartments, though, in the home, that it's possible that she could have been hidden away somewhere else and stored somewhere else, kind of like Girl in the Basement or Girl in a Box, those kinds of cases that we've talked about. So that same year, as Eugene was arrested, his father, Raymond, was released. He was released, this still being 2013, and he was 70 years old. And he, of course, took permanent residence at none other than the Chew Avenue home. And what's interesting is in December of 2013, in an interview that Raymond gave, he described himself as a frustrated, aging porn star, saying, "I walk down the street seeing all these beautiful, breathtaking women who are now totally inaccessible to me. Totally off limits now. If I stay away from mirrors, I can still convince myself that I'm 18 years old." And that's a pretty unnerving statement, right? Because you're saying you notice all these women who are inaccessible to you, off limits, but insinuating that you're pining after them and that you won't even look in the mirror because you still want to feel young and that you still have all those urges. That doesn't land very well for me. I don't know if you feel that same way, but that excerpt, I don't know, it feels pretty gross to me. So at this point, he's 70 years old. And obviously, there are not a lot of 70-year-olds who are famous porn stars. So at this point, Raymond was focusing in on his photography rather than starring in these porn films himself. And it was also around this time that Raymond began wearing an eye patch, though his friends weren't sure if it was medically necessary or if it was part of this new villain persona that he was trying to exude. However, his photography, it really did gain some attention in Europe, and it also appeared in an erotic art gallery. However, I will say, some galleries were a bit reluctant to show his images of drug-addicted women because it felt not only exploitative, but felt also like you don't want to glamorize that, right? Then, a year later in 2014, Raymond held an exhibition at Papermill Artist Studios in Kensington. And at this exhibition, he featured increasingly disturbing photographs of women struggling with heroin addiction. And in the finale of this exhibit, Raymond played a video where he claimed that this woman, and it showed this woman, but this is what he claims, that it showed a woman who had died of an overdose after he paid her for sex. Then it was followed by footage of her body being cremated, which remember, they found 5 urns at the property. Now, this exhibition obviously shocked the attendees. One local technician described Raymond as, quote, totally shameless. Like, why would you show this footage? Why would you present this to people who are viewing your art? This is not art. This is horrible. Then fast forward 2 more years, and here's where we're starting to catch up with the now timeline. On June 3rd, 2016, Amy McHale, his ex-wife, went to go visit Raymond at the home, and it was the last time that she was seen alive. And as I mentioned before, police were suspicious of her disappearance, and they did question Raymond, but they didn't have enough probable cause to arrest him. And Eugene, his son, was still in prison at the time for all those drug charges. He wasn't released until July of 2016, which that is likely why the investigators on Eugene's case didn't connect the dots right away. The following year, in 2017, Raymond released his documentary titled Whore, which featured Krista Killen, who was a longtime figure in his work. She had first appeared in his 2003 film Slaves, and then years later, Raymond filmed her discussing her drug use, and he described her behavior as slow suicide. Now, Krista lived on and off at the Chu Avenue house, and she also helped Raymond with different errands as his eyesight was deteriorating. According to a friend, Raymond became very upset, though, when she left, and he once posted a very humiliating photo of Krista while she was knee-deep suffering from withdrawal so that he could retaliate against her and embarrass her. That friend also said that Krista never feared that Raymond would hurt her, but she was concerned about what might happen to Krista if she was left alone in the house with Eugene. By 2018, Raymond was now in his late 70s, and he would frequently visit a former crack house on Wensley Street in Kensington, which is coincidentally the same area where Maribel Freshus disappeared that summer. According to a woman familiar with Raymond and also familiar with his methods of recruiting women for his dark art, he was still actively seeking out women in the area. And he was frequenting that crack house all the way up until 2022 when he met none other than Blair, the same Blair whose identification was found inside the car with Eugene in the traffic stop just back in June of 2026. Now, Blair was estranged from her family in Northeast Philadelphia, and she had also been in and out of prison. But her friends remember her as being very loyal and generous. She often would stay for long stretches at Raymond's house, where he claimed that she worked as his home health aide. Her last known Facebook post was on August 17th, 2022. And it wasn't uncommon for Blair to go months without talking to friends or family. However, there were these 2 friends that thought it was suspicious enough that she had gone several months without reaching out at all. And they're the ones who ultimately reported her missing in February of 2023, telling the police that she was last seen at Raymond's house on Chu Avenue. Another woman who had spent time at the crack house that Raymond would frequent said that overdoses were, yeah, a grim reality there, but people disappearing was not the reality there. And that ultimately is what made these friends file the missing persons report. So by late 2024, Krista was back living with Raymond and Eugene. Raymond's health had been declining, while Krista was battling a year-long infection in her leg that ultimately required doctors to amputate it above the knee. She ended up being arrested in March of 2025 after police found her sleeping in a car with illegal drugs and drug paraphernalia. And it's really not connected to the case itself, but I did want to point it out because of the stark difference in her appearance. I mean, if you're watching the video version of this episode, you can tell. She looks completely different than she did less than 10 years ago when she starred in Raymond's film. So she was arrested, then released, and in May of 2025, Raymond ended up dying at the age of 82. That left Krista and Eugene alone in this house. But remember, Krista had to be amputated from above the knee, so she was unable to move around on her own without assistance. Then, just 3 days after Raymond's death, a lit cigarette sparked a fire in Krista's second floor bedroom. The fire destroyed most of her belongings, and it also led the police to discover guns and a marijuana grow operation inside the house. That resulted in Eugene being jailed once again, but also, like we've seen, released just a few weeks later. Then on August 16th, 2025, just 3 months after Raymond's death, Krista died of a drug overdose. Eugene went ahead and announced Krista's death on her own Facebook page, writing, "Please let everyone know we were in love and we were going to get married," which is just such a weird thing to post. And we've talked about this in other cases too, where people will post a tribute to somebody on Facebook, either on their page or on the victim's page, and it's a tribute that has nothing to do with the individual itself, but it's more a reflection of them or something that they want to say to make themselves look like they're in a good light. So to have this woman die of an overdose and for him to post, "Please let everyone know we were in love and we were going to get married," it was like, what the hell is happening here? And her friends said that neither one of those claims was true. And when they asked about a funeral, Eugene just told them that he had Krista cremated, which, remember, there were 5 urns inside that house. Which, sure enough, that might actually be one of the only things that checks out in all of this, because during my research, I was able to find a comment from Eugene on a Google review for Philadelphia cremations. It says, "They are very caring and easy to talk with and handle arrangements. The process was done quickly and her remains were sent to a local funeral home, though it was on the other side of the city from where I live and it took an hour to get there with traffic, but it was during morning rush hour. Other than that, they were great to deal with and the cost was the lowest available without all the unnecessary overhead. Her remains came in a decent black plastic temporary urn and I had already purchased a marble urn for her myself, so I just transferred the ashes to it easily as they were in a plastic bag inside the urn. I was upset and a mess at the time and they made the process easy for me, which I appreciated greatly. I would give them a 10 out of 10! Exclamation mark. Which this review, again, to me, like, strikes me as odd. Like, you're reviewing the process and the business. Nobody needs to know the history or your issues that came up during it. Nobody cares that you were in morning rush hour traffic. Nobody cares that you purchased a different urn and it was an easy transfer. It just seemed, I don't know, a little off to me. But again, maybe that's just me. But with that being said, I do think that it's safe to assume one of the 5 urns that were found probably most likely contains Krista's remains. And this is where I think Eugene really started to spiral. Because according to neighbors, Eugene was, yeah, a little bit rattled after his dad Raymond's death. But after Krista died, he completely unraveled. They described him as quiet and jittery, often outside washing his black BMW. In fact, in March of 2026, just a few months before all of this came to a head, he was arrested for allegedly stabbing a man over a dispute with a woman. The case was later thrown out, though, when the victim failed to appear, so Eugene was released in May after spending 2 months in prison, but that was that. And just like that, Eugene was able to go back to being himself, growing the same drugs, picking up on vulnerable women, getting pulled over by the police, but only this time, as we know, it would be the last time, thanks to that fake ID that had Blair's name on it, the fake federal agency identification cards, and all of the other evidence that they seized. Now, I want to be clear. As of right now, Eugene has not been charged with any homicides. He also remains held without bond. Obviously, I'm going to continue digging and trying to find out more information, but this is where it gets concerning. How many women along the way did Raymond pick up? Has Eugene picked up? How many women are in those urns? Are those the missing women that have been cremated? What will they have found in all of the hidden compartments? What is all of the electronic evidence that they have to go through over the 600,000 images and 70,000 videos that they've only gone through 5 to 7% of it? What is really going on inside this house? Who is this man, Eugene? What has he done? Was this something that he was groomed into by his father? Is this his own sinister actions and desires and twistedness from mirroring his father? What the hell is happening? And more importantly, who was that woman who was pulled over with Eugene who had Blair's ID? That still has not been disclosed. She's about 39 years old. They don't know who she is. However, apparently, based on her conversations with the police, she said that the way that Eugene would talk about Blair and the missing women, it made her feel as though something bad had happened to the women. So we don't know who she is. We don't know if she's his friend, his partner, what, but it does appear that he disclosed a lot of information to her. So we'll see what she says. I don't know, though. I'm curious if you think that these missing women are connected to Eugene or Raymond or both. I for sure do. I think that it seems pretty telling. However, when you start going through the timeline as we did, Raymond was in jail when Gabrielle went missing, and Eugene was in jail when Amy, Raymond's ex-wife, went missing. But does that mean they were tag teaming and they were both helping each other and that they were like birds of a feather in this? I don't know. And who do the other urns belong to? Whose remains are inside of them? Also, I'm curious if you think that that letter that the investigators found was actually Raymond's and were instructions maybe that Raymond left for Eugene. Because remember, it was kind of a playbook. It was how to do this, how to dispose of stuff, outlining how to harm people, all these different things. So was he passing down his knowledge in his old age to his son so that he could continue his sick and twisted legacy? I don't know. It is a lot to untangle. So I started with the timeline. I'm still doing the deep dive into it, still researching. I will definitely let you know when there is a part two, when more information comes out. But I wanted to make sure I got this out to you because, like I said at the top of this episode, so many of you have been asking about this case. And if you've never seen a photo of Eugene, just Google it for all of my audio-only listeners. It is incredibly terrifying. It really is. It sends like a chill down my spine. So I will keep you posted. Let me know what you guys think. And sorry for probably making you sick and ruining your day, but it had to be done, okay? All right, guys, until the next one, be nice, don't kill people, don't join any cults, and stay away as best as possible from any House of Horror situations. Okay, bye.